Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Imagine a time when women in this country did not have the right to vote. It was not that long ago, just a few generations. The year 2020 marks the centennial of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The 19th Amendment prohibits states and federal government from denying the right to vote to citizens of the U.S. based on the basis of sex. And the adoption of the amendment was the culmination of a decades-long suffrage movement, as it was called, a campaign which was fought at both state and national levels to achieve the vote for women. First in Congress and then in the state legislatures, the movement finally produced a ratified 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. That was back in August of 1920. My guest this hour is Sally Roche Wagner. She's editor of a new anthology of the most influential writings, speeches, and reports that shaped and established that movement. The collection, with a foreword by Gloria Steinem, is titled The Women's Suffrage Movement. Sally Roche Wagner is a writer, lecturer, and activist who's researched women's studies for over 40 years. In fact, she was awarded one of the first doctorates in the country for her work in women's studies, is the founder of one of the first college-level women's studies programs in the U.S., and currently she teaches women's suffrage history in the honors program at Syracuse University. She joins us for this hour. Sally Roche Wagner, welcome to the program. What a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, Ben. Glad to be with you.
We want to invite our listeners this hour to share your thoughts and questions about this decades-long struggle for the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote, and its relevance for today. We want to talk about that, certainly, as we get into the further into the hour. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Sally, now this is a story that has been told many times in the past 100 years. What's different about the focus you gave in editing this collection?
Well, I think, Ben, typically we have the story of 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention, straight through to 1920 for the vote. And that story is incomplete in every single way. Let's just start with the very beginning. Women didn't get the right to vote or have a political voice on this land 100 years ago. History doesn't begin with white people. Native women, indigenous women, have had political voice on this land, in some cases for over 1,000 years. For example, the Haudenosaunee, or the Iroquois women who influenced the early suffragists, had political voice when the Iroquois Confederacy, the Six Nation Confederacy, was founded 1,000 years ago. So it's a little bit sobering and a little bit, you know, gives us a little bit of humility, doesn't it, to say,
right,
maybe we have something to learn from these women still today if they've had political voice that long. The Klan mothers, the Six Nation traditional Klan mothers, still nominate, hold in office, choose the chiefs, and remove them if necessary. One of the rules is that the man cannot have committed a sexual abuse of women.
Hmm. And is it true that women, white women in this country, if we specify that subset, we're actually working to regain their voting rights during the suffrage movement? The time of the founding fathers and the pioneering of this country included women in some kind of voting capacity?
Exactly. You've got it. Women voted when the property qualification was the qualification for voting. If you had enough property, you could vote. And in some cases in the colonies, women voted. So when the suffragists began organizing in the 1800s, the middle of the 19th century, they said, we are not asking for a new right. We are asking for the restitution of a right that our foremothers had.
Mm-hmm. So how was that right limited to white women who were landowners, a certain limit there, but How was that right taken away? Why didn't it go hand in hand? Because in the founding of our founding fathers' days, you had to be a landowner to vote, right? You couldn't be just anybody.
Well, when the states, after the Revolution, formed their constitutions, every single state put in voting qualifications that were gender and race-based. So they eliminated women, they eliminated African-American men from voting. And they did it not all at once. In fact, in New Jersey, they didn't. The women and African-American men voted until I think it was 1804. And then they swung an election, and the white men were so mad they eliminated the women and African-American men from voting.
Interesting. Sally Roche Wagner is my guest this hour, longtime writer, lecturer, activist in the field of women's studies. She has a new anthology out called The Women's Suffrage Movement. We are on the eve of celebrating. I'm sure the celebration will go on this year into 2020, the passage of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which gave women the right to vote. Join us with your questions and thoughts for Sally Roche Wagner, 1-866-780-9100. Sally, in this collection, you explore some areas that we don't certainly get in, at least in my textbook, many years ago, growing up. You explore segregation and racism within the women's suffrage movement. Tell us what connections are there.
You know, that's the, it's we have something to celebrate, and we also have a place of accountability. There was a merger between the more progressive and the more conservative wings of the women's suffrage movement in 1890. And the movement at that point began to say, and increasingly said, we're working for state rights. We're allowing the states. We're actually asking the states to give us the right to vote. Well, if you think about what's going on at this time, this is when the southern states are denying African-American men the vote. You know, it's still kind of up for grabs whether or not the federal government or the state governments determine voting qualifications. And states' rights, in fact, has the effect of strengthening the taking away of the vote from African-American men. As you think about it, if I say to you, please give me the right to vote as a woman, doesn't that on the other side mean now you can take it away from black men that you don't want to vote? The organized women's suffrage movement went one step further. They practiced states' rights. They said the southern states can do, well, each state can do whatever they want. So southern states were allowed to segregate. The state societies of the women's rights movement were allowed to segregate. They were allowed to work for the vote for white women only, and they were also allowed to work for Jim Crow laws. Mm-hmm. They began to make the argument, give women the right to vote, because white women outnumber Negroes and immigrants, men and women, and woman suffrage is a way to maintain white, native-born supremacy. And they use that term, white, native-born supremacy.
Mm-hmm. And this National American Women Woman Suffrage Association, this was formed in the late 1890s, advocated women's suffrage. So to what degree did that association partner, work with what we would say are racist politicians?
I think they were courting the racist politicians. They believed that they needed to win the South in order to get the vote, and they were willing to, they called it expediency. Susan B. Anthony explained it to Ida B. Wells, said, you know, I'm personally opposed to segregation and racism. Didn't use that term, but, you know, she had a great track record personally. But she said, in order to get women the vote, we have to practice this expediency. Now, I think historians have often seen that as sort of inevitable. Well, of course they had to. You know, we still practice expediency today. Throw somebody under the bus in order that somebody else can get their rights. And we can think about it, I think, in a different way. What if they had instead made a partnership with the African American men who could now vote all over the country. What if they had made a partnership with the immigrant men who could now vote all over the country? If they had, instead of fighting against those groups, made them as allies, could it have been a different, you know, playing field?
And what is your answer to that hypothetical?
I have no idea. It's a hypothetical.
Okay.
But I think that the very speculation of that, I hope, allows us to look at, when we're tempted to practice expediency today, to sort of look around and say, wait a minute, is this inevitable, or is there some other direction we could go? The problem with expediency is that you often win the battle, but you lose the war.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that we actually won. We won the battle, yes, and that is to celebrate. But we lost the war because African American women and men really didn't have the vote until the 1960s and the voter protection laws that eliminated the Jim Crow laws. But still today we're experiencing voter suppression. So I think that, you know, the sort of playing into that and strengthening the voter suppression laws is part of the legacy that we just need to come to grips with about the suffrage movement. There's much to celebrate. The book is full of women and their male allies who did extraordinary work in all areas of women's rights. But we also have this place of accountability.
Let's focus, if we could, Sally Roche Wagner, on a few of the key leaders of the movement. Susan B. Anthony, of course, we all know. Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Also here in Iowa, in the Midwest, we especially know Carrie Chapman Catt, born in Wisconsin, graduate of Iowa State University in the late 1800s. She, as I mentioned, was born in Wisconsin at the close of the Civil War, according to her biography. Her family moved to a farm near Charles City, here in Iowa, went to Iowa State University between 1877 and 1880. And, of course, Iowa State University now has the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Politics. We have many guests connected with that wonderful, prestigious center on this program. So tell us a little bit about Carrie Chapman Catt. She was a key figure. What should we remember her most for?
Well, she's a mixed bag, I think, as many of the historic figures are, and maybe some of us are as well. Carrie Chapman Catt's an extraordinary leader. She is a leader at a time that she's really strengthening the movement in the National American Woman Suffrage Association. The two terms are the two separate times that she's president. She really strengthens the consolidation, the power at the top, so that it is really, you know, it's questions about, is that the best style of leadership? But the result was that it did consolidate power, and the leadership was able to, you know, move things forward in ways. I think she had a vision of really directing the states in the work they should do. She was powerfully important in working for world peace. I think that's one of the things she is sometimes forgotten for as we look at her leadership in the suffrage movement. But the place of accountability for Carrie Chapman Catt is that she was the president of the National American Woman Suffrage Association in the time that they were making the argument for white supremacy.
Okay, and any other amendments to her shining name, or that is the singular one you want to point out? It's a big one.
You know, I'm going to just shout out to one African American woman that I think we don't typically know about, and that's Mary Ann Shad Carey. Mary Ann Shad Carey was the first African-American woman to publish a weekly newspaper on the North American continent. She was in Canada, which was after the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, the only place where African Americans really found safety. There was no safety anymore on United States soil. And she published a newspaper in Canada, but she comes back to the United States during the Civil War and acts as a recruiter for African American soldiers to fight in the war. She goes on to get a law degree. She is a teacher. She's just an extraordinary, richly, what would we call her, a Renaissance woman today.
Mm-hmm.
And she stands in for the hundreds of African-American women and men that unfortunately have really been largely written out of women's suffrage history.
Sally Roche Wagner is my guest. The Women's Suffrage Movement, a new anthology that she's edited. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. You have a long history yourself in women's studies, as I mentioned at the outset, Sally. But so perhaps you can help us and some of our younger listeners who may find it hard to imagine that just a few generations ago, women were denied the right to vote. Help us understand the mindset in which this made any kind of sense, because it was a controversial issue, right?
Mm-hmm. It was. And it's even worse than the vote. When the founding fathers formed the country, Abigail Adams warned them, do not adopt the repressive Blackstone Code of Common Law that England had just adopted. Well, founding fathers went ahead anyway and did it. And under the Blackstone Code, once women married, they were considered dead in the law. They had no legal existence. So, of course, they couldn't sue or be sued. They couldn't serve on a jury. They couldn't vote. But beyond that, they had no right to their property. Once you married, everything you brought into the marriage or anything you earned became your husband's. The wages you earned at the end of your pay period went to your husband, not to you.
Mm-hmm.
And he could do anything he wanted to with it. And I think the most chilling of all is that husbands had the right, and some practiced this, to will away an unborn child. Let's say that the husband is on his deathbed, and he writes a will, and in that will, he says, this child that my wife is carrying will be given to so-and-so once it is born. And that child would be ripped from the mother's arms and given to its rightful owner, and she had no legal protection.
And he didn't have to prove anything? He didn't have to prove that she was an unfit mother or anything of the sort?
No.
Mm-hmm.
Because she had no right to her children. She had no right to her body. Husbands could beat their wives as long as they did it with not inflicting any permanent damage. One Supreme Court in the South said, you know, to interfere in this would be to upset the domestic tranquility of the home.
Wow.
Which rested on male authority.
Right. And as you bring out in the book, so this is how we get to a point where we have men celebrated who fought against slavery but continued to support the subordinate position of their wives and their daughters.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm looking for the rationale. Those are just shocking facts, but what is the rationale? If we were talking to someone, you know, we often have debates on this show. If I could take this show back to the middle 1800s, late 1800s, and get a real a voice that would be arguing against suffragists. So what would be the arguments?
I think it would be a man of the cloth. And what he would say is, read your Bible. And this was the argument that was given. The sin of Eve results in her being put under the authority of men. She's to be, you know, she's to give birth in pain and sorrow and be under the authority of her husband. Well, that continues on all the way through the New Testament to St. Paul. And so the religious argument was that if you are to kind of be a good, God-fearing woman, you're not going to stand up to the authority of your husband because you are to be under his authority. And of course you wouldn't vote. That would upset God's divine plan. So that was the argument. And actually, one of the major theorists of the women's rights movement, Matilda Joslyn Gage, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton both made the argument, this is what happened. Canon law and the idea that the two shall become one and the one is the man became the foundation for common law. And that then was translated into the woman, you know, becomes obedient to her husband and ceases to exist once she marries. But I need to give a shout out to the ministers that didn't follow this position, including Samuel J. May, who was a Unitarian minister in Syracuse, New York, who preached a sermon for women's rights in 1845, 3 years before the Seneca Falls Convention. And he said, you men need to be more Christ-like and you women need to become more aggressive. You men, think about how you would feel if your wives made every decision for you. Well, that's how they feel.
How did the women's suffrage movement, I imagine in a variety of ways, but by and large, how did the women's suffrage movement deal with this religious element that women should subordinate themselves to men?
There was challenge to it. Elizabeth Cady Stanton brought together a group of women in 1895 and then 1898 for the second volume of A Woman's Bible, in which, you know, clergy at that time and theologians were actually interpreting the Bible. And so she brought together, they were all men, she brought together a group of women to do that. Oh, she said the clergy danced like parched peas on a hot stove. She was continually accused of, this book is the work of the devil himself, to which she calmly responded, nope, there was not a single man on our revising committee. So if somebody tells you that suffragists had no sense of humor, give them that story.
Okay. We have to take a short break. Please stay with us. Sally Roche Wagner is with us. She's editor of a new anthology. You should check it out. Most influential writings, is their speeches, reports, give you a sense of the time of the suffragette movement, this movement that culminated nearly 100 years ago when the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was ratified and became the law of the land. We'll talk more with Sally Roche Wagner when we return, including want to ask about the relevancy of that campaign of the suffragists to activists today. Also, a comparison of the women who fought in the late 1800s, early 20th century with the feminists of the 1960s. We'll ask about that. If you have any thoughts or questions about the struggle for the 19th Amendment, equality for women, we're going to talk about equal pay will be a topic when we come back as well. Sally Roche Wagner, the women's suffrage movement, her new anthology, we'll be back in just a moment, featuring some of the most influential writing, speeches, and reports that shaped the road to the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote in this country. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
We're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with my guest this hour, Sally Roche Wagner. She's the editor of a new anthology called The Women's Suffrage Movement. A lot of influential writing, a collection of speeches, reports. It really highlights the words of the women, the key figures in this decades-long struggle that culminated in the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution in 1920. Also exploring some areas that perhaps were not in your high school or grade school history book, exploring segregation and racism within the women's suffrage movement. So we would like to have you join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Gloria Steinem, the journalist and feminist, social political activist, writing the foreword to Sally's book, writing about this work. It allows us to witness the words and acts dreams and disappointments, victories and defeats, visionary ideas, and tactical errors of people fighting a battle that laid the basis for our continuing movement against hierarchies based on race and gender. It is this faithfulness to the past that allows us to learn lessons for changes in the present and the future. Part of that foreword to this book by written there by Gloria Steinem. Let's go to our phones. Sally, you're still there, I assume?
I sure am.
Well, glad you could be with us for this second half hour. Jim is with us in Spencer, listening to the program in Northwest Iowa. Hi, Jim. What's on your mind as you listen to the fascinating conversation, facts brought up by Sally Roche Wagner?
Yeah, hi. You know, I'm frequently dismayed when this subject comes up, and it seems that the Native American women were ignored by the women's movement in this regard. I don't believe any Native Americans were allowed to vote until after World War II, and I thought that was kind of a racist type of action that allowed them to be left out.
Mm. Jim, thank you. In Spencer, your comment, Sally, on that.
Oh, thank you, Jim. That's really important to bring that up. I think, you know, the wonder of Native women having political voice before the United States was formed, and then with the process of colonization, with the process of forced assimilation, losing it. In 1888, the International Council of Women, a woman named Alice Fletcher, who was an early ethnographer, spoke to the women who had gathered for the first time in the United States from around the European countries to talk about their rights. And she was talking about Native women, and she said, she first of all gives this story, a little anecdote about, she said, I was sitting with a group of Omaha women from the Omaha Nation, and one of the women gave away a horse. And she said, without thinking, I said, hadn't you better check with your husband first? She said, the merriment with which my statement was made, I forgot just for a minute that I was not with white women. White women could not have given away a piece of their property without their husband's approval. But the Native women, and this is in the 1880s, thought it was just hilarious that she would suggest that a woman would have to check with her husband. That's the kind of authority that women had. Alice Fletcher goes on to tell these women, gathered internationally, that she has spoken to Native men, leaders, and women. The women say they're really concerned about what's going to happen when they're forced into United States law. And she said, but speaking to one of the chiefs, and I figured out later she was talking about Sitting Bull, he said to her, you know, we're really concerned about what's going to happen to us as a people when there's an attempt to force us under U.S. law. But we're more concerned about the women, because those women will lose their rights, their position, not just as Indians, but also as women. They'll doubly lose their position. So I think there was this really strong sense of the knowledge and being inspired by, you know, white women were being told this is can't happen, it's against God's will, it's against nature, you know, you're the clinging vine to the mighty oak. But they saw Native women who were practicing a power is not the right word, an authority, a self-authority, a self-sovereignty. That process of assimilation really takes that away, and you're right. 1924 is when the United States government recognized Native people as citizens if they chose to be. Of course, this is really controversial today within the Indian, the Native communities, because some nations say, no, we are absolutely sovereign, and we are not going to practice United States citizenship. Others say, yes, well, you know, we're dual citizens of our own Native nations, but also of the United States. And so they have even been part of electing Native women to office today, which we saw happen in the 2018 election. But even with that 1924 constitutional, well, it was a law, you know, Indian citizenship. Even with that, there were some states in which Native people attempted to vote into the 1960s and were not allowed to. And I think recently in South Dakota, I know that's where I grew up, there have been cases of voter suppression of Native nations. And North Dakota, you know, where they had to have physical addresses. So, yeah, it's a very complicated but really important thing to bring up, Jim. Thanks.
Jim and Spencer, thanks for your call. Sally Roche Wagner, if you just joined us, my guest for the rest of the hour, the Women's Suffrage Movement, a new anthology that she has researched and put together, also coming up on the centennial of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, giving the U.S. Giving American women the right to vote. But as you pointed out, Sally, this is about this whole, it's more about more than just the vote. It's tied up with a lot of other unequal parts when we talk about the genders here. I found it fascinating that these suffragists used particular notable celebrations of our early country to really point out hypocrisy, staging some protests at the centennial of the Boston Tea Party, the Declaration of Independence when that turned 100, the dedication of the Statue of Liberty. There you have it, Lady Liberty there, dedicated at a time when women were not allowed to vote.
Exactly. There's this whole campaign of nonviolent civil disobedience that they practice, the National Woman Suffrage Association. They say on the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party, no taxation without representation. They refused to pay their taxes until they were represented, until they had a vote. They said, you know, we really have the right to vote. This is a republic, isn't it? Based on the consent of the governed. And how is consent given? Through the ballot. So they presented themselves at the polls. They voted. They attempted to vote. When they were denied, they took their cases to court. And actually, one reached the Supreme Court, Minor versus Happersett, 1875. She sued the registrar that refused to let her register to vote for $10,000. And the Supreme Court decided, the nine white men, unanimously, they said, this is one case that can be said to be settled now and forever. Women do not have the right to vote protected in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. So, 1876, yes, they issued a Declaration of Rights of Women, presented it illegally, said they had greater cause for discontent, rebellion, and revolution than did the fathers of 1776, and they did their action knowing they might be arrested, presenting this declaration. They said they did it for the daughters of 1976, so they would know that their mothers of 1876 had impeached the government for its treatment of women.
Sally, we will be celebrating the 19th Amendment this year, next year, into 2020. Did women all gain the right to vote at the same time? Because this was also a battle in the states as well.
They really, you know, they 1920 protected federally, but there was a progression state by state and actually territory by territory as well. The first place women were, you know, allowed to vote was in Wyoming Territory in 1869. Now, the difference, of course, between territories and states is that territories can't vote for a congressional representative, they can't vote for a senator, and they can't vote for the president. So it was really more local election. But state by state, women did. By the time the ratification of the amendment, women voted in a number of states around the country. And that pressured then the congressmen, and they were all congressmen at that point, representing them to pass the amendment and then pass it on to the states for ratification.
Well, let's tie this into relevance for today. What would you say can activists learn from this suffrage movement back then? Lessons to learn from, mistakes to learn from?
I think one of them is to really question expediency, to look at, you know, what's the larger picture here of freedom that we're working for, and whose freedom is at stake right now in this moment, and to make that net as wide as possible so nobody gets left out. I think another one is to recognize that we're working now for rights that these women were demanding 150 years ago. Equal pay for equal work, for example. That was old hat in 1850. You know, it was women are making a third to half the wages men are making, so we should be paid the same for the same quality of work, the same kind of work. And today we know, of course, that we're a little over 75%. That's 150 years ago from 50 to 75%. At this rate, will it be 150 years before we get pay equity? You know, I think we look at that long spectrum and, you know, we got to move faster here, right?
I think everyone would agree with you on that. Let's talk about, you mentioned the women that we had in 2018, a record number of women being in Congress, mostly from the Democratic Party. What are your reflections on women in politics today about this record number of women in Congress? Of course, it pales in comparison to some other countries with much larger percentages of women in their bodies.
Yeah, I think it is. As you suggest, Ben, it's kind of a mixed feeling, isn't it? That at the same time that we celebrate that, well, we've made it a little better, we are 75th out of 192 nations in terms of the percentage of women that are in political office. We need to do better than this. We are the laughing stock of the world. As we say, we're going to export democracy, but we're not practicing it at home.
Mm-hmm. What are you watching as we enter? Well, of course, you're speaking primarily to Iowa listeners here, and we have the caucus campaign season well underway. What are you watching with a record number of women presidential candidates, for instance?
Well, this is very exciting, and of course, we all have our eyes on Iowa because you are the deciders in many ways, the beginning to, you know, of the process. I think, again, it's, you know, we are so long overdue for a female president that I think just to sort of, you know, bring ourselves up to a little better position in the eyes of the world, we really need to have a woman president. And there are a number of women that are highly qualified that are running. So, mm-hmm. You know, we'll see what happens. You know, it needs to be the best qualified person, but that often is a woman.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to have you compare the leaders in the suffrage movement from the 1800s into the early 1900s with the feminists of the 1960s that caused that sort of second revolution of working for women's equality. What do you see when you look at those two groups?
Well, I will admit that I am a proud card-carrying member of Veteran Feminists of America.
Okay.
A group of us that we were active in the movement before 1973. So I taught my first women's studies class 50 years ago. So I feel like I'm a part of that second wave. I think the sadness I feel is that we did not know a history of the women that went before us. We didn't know that they were fighting for the rights that we thought we had invented, you know, the struggle. We could have learned so much from them if we had known. And that was a lot, quite honestly, of what caused me to do this book, Ben, was that, you know, there's waves of feminism that keep emerging and emerging, and we need to know our history to know what we can build on.
I'd like to get your reaction to a poll that came out in just the last few days. This is a Politico Morning Consult poll. The poll taken almost 2,000 registered voters across the country online in March of 2019. One of the findings here was that more than half of Democratic voters, 55%, think men are better off than women in the U.S., but only a fifth of Republicans share that view. Why do you think there is this disparity between the way Democratic and Republican voters view how women are doing in this country?
You know, I think that the interesting thing is that this is not a, you know, my gut tells me. This is empirical data. You know, we can look at the studies. We can look at, in fact, you know, how are women doing? Well, in every measurement that we can find, we are not on the same level, the same par with men. So it's really a matter of who is accepting reality and who is not.
Hmm. You've been active in the field of women's studies, you mentioned, for 50 years. What are your personal reflections on the change that has occurred? It must be, as we've mentioned a number of times, a mixed bag for you.
You know, it is. It's part of me is just full of celebration because I have lived to see things that I never thought I would live to see. You know, we've made inroads that are incredible. One of the things that we had a dream of was that we thought if we change the institutions enough, we begin to change the human beings that those institutions create. And my granddaughter is a different human being than I am because we changed the conditions that allowed her possibilities that I never had.
Mm-hmm. Do you run into young women Yeah. You running?
Oh, that's the celebration part. You know, there's the other part, of course, the disappointment that we should be doing this so much faster.
Right. In as we come up into 2020, the election year, in your book is mentioned, you can tell us about Victoria Woodhull. This is something that the first woman to declare her candidacy for the president of the United States. And
yes,
you point
indeed.
Out she spent election night in jail. Tell us that story.
This is one of the amazing stories of history, I think, that we don't learn about in school. So Victoria Woodhull, yes, announced her candidacy, and then she was arrested under the Comstock Act. These were religious fundamentalists that got laws passed state and federal that allowed one man, Anthony Comstock, to determine what was obscene in the United States of America, and he determined anything to do with sex or reproduction or the stopping of reproduction, anything was obscene. Victoria Woodhull published in the newspaper that she published with her sister, she published two hashtag MeToo stories. One was the most famous minister in America, Henry Ward Beecher, who was using his position to sexually coerce his female parishioners. The other one was two Wall Street operatives that Victoria and her sister watched at a big party. Watch them get two girls, young girls, one 15, one 16, watch them get systematically drunk, these girls drunk, and then to sexually violate them and to brag about it afterwards. And she was arrested for obscenity for publishing this truth about these men who were sexually violating women.
And she spent election night in jail. What year would this have been?
She sure did, 1872.
Mm. We have about a minute left, Sally. You've met, so to speak, so many suffragists in putting this collection together, in researching it, in your work in 50 years in the field of women's studies. Do you have a suffragist or two that you would like to meet if you could get that wish?
You know, it was a movement, and there are so many incredible women and their male supporters that I would just love to be part of a big party with all of them.
Okay, with all of them, okay. what movements, let me ask you this then in closing, what movements today do you most admire or do you think have some deep connection with the suffragists?
You know, I think the most unexpected one is the reproductive justice movement. These suffragists, we very, very little know about this position they took. Let's take Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Matilda Joslyn Gage, the two major theorists. They strongly believed in the rights of the unborn, and they said the most fundamental right of every unborn is to be wanted and chosen, that no child should come into the world through force or coercion of law or religion. They should be chosen and wanted. So I think that part of the movement is one that we so don't know about.
Okay. In 15 seconds, what would you like most of all for people to take away from this collection?
Be active. Get involved. Change the world.
All right. We'll leave the hour with those words from you, Sally Roche Wagner, editor of this new collection with a foreword by Gloria Steinem titled The Women's Suffrage Movement. Sally Roche Wagner, it's been tremendous having you on the hour. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your research with us.
Oh, Ben, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop and Emily Woodbury with help today from Camus Leeson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, I guess it's already Wednesday tomorrow, a Politics Wednesday edition. Tomorrow with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. We'll have you join us to catch up on the latest on the political landscape tomorrow on this program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.